Hey everybody, welcome back to another episode of The Negotiation. I'm your host, Todd Embley, and on today's show, I speak with Joe Mazur, senior analyst at Trivium China, on the complexities of the U.S.-China relationship in the early days of the second Trump administration. Joe offers a comprehensive overview of the trade measures implemented by the U.S. since Donald Trump's re-election, analyzing the motives behind the tariffs and their potential to escalate into more aggressive actions. He also analyzes China's response to U.S. tariffs, which include a series of non-reciprocal measures. Joe explains their strategic significance and implications for future negotiations. The conversation also touches on recent U.S. restrictions in the semiconductor industry, highlighting the critical role this sector plays in the broader technological conflict between the U.S. and China, as well as the closure of the de minimis exemption for Chinese goods. We also gain a comprehensive understanding of the current state and potential future of U.S.-China economic relations, the strategic motivations behind recent policies, and the implications for companies from various sectors. Enjoy.
Yeah. So, I mean, when we're talking about the 10% tariffs, I think that China has been prepared for this eventuality for months. And I think overall, a 10% flat tariff on Chinese goods, I mean, it'll be felt in maybe some sectors with thinner margins. But overall, I don't think it's going to be much of a game changer in terms of China's overall economic outlook. And probably it'll mean even less to the U.S. Of course, you know, when we talk about the U.S., that's going to be in conjunction with all the other tariffs that Trump has either actually or threatened to put on other countries. So it won't be existing in isolation.
Home to over 4 billion people, the Asia-Pacific region boasts one of the most powerful consumer markets on the planet. Not only is it home to half of the world's under 30 population, but it's also home to more than half the world's internet users. It's a market that no globally minded organization should ignore. But entering markets like China, Japan, or Southeast Asia is no easy task. Just ask the likes of Microsoft, Google, Uber, and Facebook. However, times are changing, and with the right partners, doors are slowly opening as more and more companies find success growing their key markets in APAC. I myself spent 8 years in China, mostly as a venture capitalist, helping early-stage tech companies grow in the Asia-Pacific market successfully. This show is dedicated to uncovering and examining successful Asia market entry and growth strategies by interviewing the experts who've done it before and truly understand what it takes to be successful in the region. My name is Todd Embley, and welcome to The Negotiation. Negotiation, brought to you by WPIC Marketing and Technologies.
Joe, welcome back to the Negotiation Podcast.
Thank you, Todd. It's good to be back.
All right. So where in the world are you where we're recording you from today?
I'm in beautiful Beijing, China, and it's actually one of those bluebird winter days. So very nice, very sunny, chilly, of course. But yeah, good to be in Beijing.
All right. Give us a quick temperature reading. In Celsius and Fahrenheit, if you can do both for me.
Oh, goodness. Okay. I don't know. I'm not off the top of my head. I'm not sure. I'd put it around, for the sake of easy math, 32 Fahrenheit, 0 Celsius.
That's the easiest one to possibly do. There's literally no math needed. Okay. Let's start with you giving us a summary of the U.S. trade measures against China since Trump took over the White House.
Yeah, well, it's been a very busy, not even month, believe it or not. But yeah, I think going into the first weeks of the second Trump administration, everybody was watching to see what and how far Trump would go in terms of his protectionist pledges on the campaign trail. But so far as China goes, other important U.S. trade partners are kind of another story. We saw a 10% across the board tariff on Chinese goods over China's alleged failure to do enough on fentanyl, according to the Trump administration. And also just recently, a 25% across the board tariff on steel and aluminum products from all countries coming into the U.S. So in addition to that, the Trump administration got rid of the de minimis exemption for packages coming from China. And for those who might not be familiar, that was essentially an exemption whereby packages under a value of $800 coming into the U.S. From China and other places were exempt from duties. So that's now gone. I think we'll probably talk a little more about that later. But yeah, it's basically been those three in terms of actions that have either directly or broadly targeted China.
Okay. So he pledged up to a 60% tariff on Chinese goods. any sense why he just didn't go that far right away?
Yeah, well, I mean, as always, and I think this is probably a phrase that for certainly I'm tired of saying in my analysis, and I think that you and your listeners will be disappointed to hear, but it's just, it's very hard to tell when it comes to Trump. And I think, you know, the sort of the cliche about Trump is that you should take him seriously, but not literally. So when you're talking about 60% tariffs, I mean, it's certainly possible that the initial 10% tariffs could be a prelude to something much bigger. It could be that that was just campaign trail bombast. It could be that that was intended as a negotiating position to attempt to scare China. But, you know, we're very early days, and it's really not clear how far Trump intends to go with his protectionism. I mean, if you want to look at the examples of Canada and Mexico, he threatened massive tariffs, and then, you know, for what were effectively a number of token concessions, delayed them for a month. And so who knows where that will go. So with anything having to do with Trump and tariffs, it's very hard to say necessarily how far it's going to go.
Okay. So disclaimer noted. Okay. But I still have to ask questions here. And yes, I know, very well said, take them seriously, but not literally. And you correctly noted, you know, what happened with Canada and Mexico. And it just seems right now, Canada, Mexico, China, these just seem to be the three that he's going after. One that he typically is known to go after. Canada and Mexico are also a bit of a, I mean, he did the same thing in 2018 to a degree. Steel and aluminum was one of them, but not as aggressive. So would you say, with regards to China, is he looking for a deal? Is he looking to spark negotiations? Or is this like the precursor to the more aggressive measures he mentioned?
So my instinct, based on having observed Trump 1.0, is that he is looking for a deal. That's sort of how he likes to think of himself, as a deal maker. And when it comes to relations with foreign countries, including close American allies, he views more or less everything as a transaction. And I think in the specific case of China, there are a number of examples that we can point to. So kind of a popular example is back in 2018, when Trump announced export controls on Chinese tech company ZTE. And sort of at the behest of Xi Jinping, effectively, Xi Jinping gave him a personal phone call and said something to the effect of, it sure would be nice if you were to drop those export controls. I would owe you one. And that's what he did. Right? These were export controls that would have effectively crippled the company. And based on sort of that personal diplomacy and I suppose, deal-making ethos, he was persuaded to back off on that. Another example might be the Phase One trade deal, in which Trump's team required China to buy a certain number of U.S. products, agricultural products being the primary one. And even though it was sort of widely observed that this would be unachievable, and indeed China was not able to make good on these purchases, it was something that then allowed the Trump team to declare victory and say, look at this great deal we made, where China's agreed to buy so many more American products. So I really think that when it comes to Trump's negotiating style, it is just that. It is a negotiation. I wouldn't say it's always necessarily a negotiation, you know, that's rooted in objective self-interest for the U.S., maybe in perceived self-interest. But I don't think anything is necessarily absolute when it comes to Trump's dealings with U.S. trade partners, including China.
You know, a lot of what you said, especially early on in that answer, reminded me of, and I haven't read the book, but The Art of the Deal, which was the Donald Trump book, that was actually ghostwritten by somebody who just got to really interview and pay attention to a lot of what he does. And I think the crux of some, or a takeaway from that book, was that everything is a negotiation, everything is deal making. And in Trump's mind, it is just about winning the deal. Feeling like he has won the deal. So I feel like if that's the case, that is a optimistic, hopeful, narrative that I'd like to see come to fruition for sure. I think it would be best and behoove all countries involved. As long as you're willing to deal, as long as you're willing to negotiate, as long as you're willing to have a conversation, everybody hopefully can reach a happy place. And then hopefully the optics that in Trump's perspective, he feels like he won the deal and then everybody is good. Now, assuming no additional moves with what's happened already, how will the current tariffs affect the Chinese economy? And in vice versa, how will they affect the U.S. economy?
Yeah. So, I mean, when we're talking about the 10% tariffs, I think that China has been prepared for this eventuality for months. And I think overall, a 10% flat tariff on Chinese goods, I mean, it'll be felt in maybe some sectors with thinner margins. But overall, I don't think it's going to be much of a game changer in terms of China's overall economic outlook. And probably it'll mean even less to the U.S. Of course, you know, when we talk about the U.S., that's going to be in conjunction with all the other tariffs that Trump has either actually or threatened to put on other countries. So it won't be existing in isolation. We're talking about the steel and aluminum tariffs. China officially exports very little steel and aluminum to the U.S. It's not even in the top 10, as far as I know, for those metals. What is interesting is because it is a flat tariff across all U.S. trade partners and with no exceptions and exemptions, as Trump put it, there is the question about how much Chinese steel and aluminum is actually being transshipped to the U.S. through third countries. So how much of the steel, which is nominally made in Mexico or made in Vietnam, is actually primarily made in China, but just has some light processing or finishing done in third countries. You know, it's by nature very difficult to get statistics on that. But that's potentially something that you know, it's not going to be great necessarily for Chinese steel and aluminum producers. And in addition to that, I think other steel producing countries, if they no longer see the U.S. as a viable or an inviting destination, then that means they're going to compete more with Chinese steel exporters in other markets. So, and I think that's going to sort of compound on China's overcapacity problems. And the steel industry has been one of the major criticisms that China's trade partners, not just the U.S., but globally have had about trade with China, is there's been accusations of the dumping of steel. And this will certainly make that somewhat worse. But again, nominally, you know, on the face of it, China exports very little steel and aluminum to the U.S.
I'd still like to go back to what the effect might be on the U.S. economy, which, as far as I'm concerned, this is a very difficult, you know, enigma wrapped in a riddle to see what might actually happen, because you're talking about jobs, you're talking about inflation, you're talking about cost of goods sold. There's a lot of things that are kind of going on here. And I'm just, you know, I'm going to be sitting on the sidelines here in Canada, kind of interesting to see what actually unfolds. But your take on the effect on the U.S. economy here.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think you're right. I think so much of it will depend on how much actually goes through. I mean, when you look at the threatened tariffs, you know, even if we're just looking at China, a 60% tariff on Chinese goods for the U.S. economy, there's no question that would be massively inflationary, and even more so when you add in the rest of the world, right? The question is, how many of these deals, to use that term, can Trump then complete that would potentially save the U.S. economy from the adverse effects of tariffs. So, as to the total overall impact on the U.S. economy, I mean, inflation was something that nominally his base was very concerned of. It became almost sort of a meme during the elections. Oh, the price of eggs is sort of the only issue that voters care about. I think that if Trump were to do everything that he said he was going to do with regard to tariffs on China, so that's a 60% tariff across the board, you know, possible additional tariffs due to de-dollarization was something that he threatened on the BRICS nations, of which China is one. I don't think there's any question that it's going to be hugely inflationary in the U.S. I doubt he will go through with it to that degree.
Yeah, it's going to be fun to watch. Like I said, there's just certain sectors, like avocado, I think is a fun one, because I think they're actually, almost all of them are grown in California. sent to Mexico for packaging and then sent back to the US. And, you know, a tariff on avocados that are all like 90% are actually grown with, doesn't that just kind of in a reverse way hurt, you know, your own, because it was sent out
yeah.
one thing and then comes back? And it's a, have we actually just hurt our own producers of avocados?
Well, yeah. And I mean, not to stray too far off the topic here, but if the mass deportations go ahead as Trump has suggested they would, I mean, that's obviously going to be another shock as far as labor goes. So yeah, again, to return to my initial disclaimer, right? The full scope of everything that Trump said he would do is catastrophic. I think the actual measures that are implemented will be somewhat less dramatic.
Okay, let's talk about Chinese countermeasures. Walk us through each of the countermeasures first.
Yeah, so China took what I have referred to as a multi-pronged response. So the first one was tariffs, but they were much more limited compared to Trump's tariffs. So those were a 15% tariff on U.S. coal and liquefied natural gas and a 10% tariff on crude oil, farm equipment, and some vehicles. And those came into effect on February 10th, which is, I think, this Monday as we're recording, this past Monday. So, I mean, that was a relatively underwhelming response when you're just talking tariff for tariff. But there were a number of other facets of the Chinese response which were quite interesting. So first, they placed two U.S. companies on the unreliable entity list, which is something equivalent to the American entity list. And basically, you know, it opens the door for China to hand out all kinds of punishments to these companies. And so the companies in question were PVH Group, which is the parent company of companies like Calvin Klein and Tommy Hilfiger, which has been under threat of listing since September, and Illumina, which is a U.S. biotech company and a major competitor to Chinese entities targeted by the U.S. Biosecure Act. So what's interesting about this is the first time that China has put companies on the unreliable entity list for something other than selling arms to Taiwan. So prior to this, it was almost all U.S. defense contractors ended up on the unreliable entity list. And a lot of these companies had little or no exposure to the China market for obvious reasons that it was politically risky and that something like this was quite possible. So what this means is that the unreliable entity list has gone from being something which is primarily symbolic to something that can have a real actual impact on honest to God U.S. companies who are nothing to do with the defense industry, who are operating in China. And I think I should back up and say, as of yet, the actual punishment or the consequences of these companies being on the unreliable entity list are not determined. And I think that's by design, right? China is waiting to see how things shake out in the initial conversations with the Trump team, but it is a very clear signal that, hey, we have a very direct and meaningful way of going after your companies on a company by company basis. And there's really not much you can do about it. So that's a relatively powerful piece of leverage. That's certainly going to make US companies, you know, sit up and take notice. And, you know, in a best case scenario from China's perspective to lobby the Trump administration to take them out of the firing line. So that's part two. Part three was a pretty big expansion of its export control list to include more critical minerals. So that's tungsten, tellurium, bismuth, moly, this is why I always have a hard time saying, molybdenum and indium, which are minerals and alloys that are used in a number of important industrial and defense applications. So again, really leaning on that critical minerals lever. And again, here, the last I checked, China has not prohibited the export of these materials to the US, but it is now making it very clear that it sees those materials as dual use items, which it could restrict really at any time with possibly damaging consequences to not only the US defense industry, but a number of industrial applications. And finally, number four of four is China's market regulator announced it had launched an antitrust investigation into Google It didn't really provide a lot of details as to what it is. And your listeners might be saying, oh, well, Google has been banned in China for many years. That's true. But because it does Android, and Android has something like a 70% market share in China, that is where the leverage comes in. So all told, we've got four main actions from the Chinese side. Maybe sort of a slightly asymmetric response, but I think in recognition of the fact that it does not want to go toe to toe with the U.S. on tariffs. So maybe a way of thinking about it is, it is tit for tat, but it's not like for like.
Okay, nice. Yeah, you had me a little bit on the trip down memory lane to grade eight science and thinking about the periodic table. I'm pretty sure molybdenum is Mb. On the periodic table.
We have to go refer back to the old Tom Lehrer song, the element song.
Yeah, exactly. But yes, okay. And then good call on the Google thing. That's exactly what I've kind of seen. I mean, the Android and, Huawei's really stepped up their game. But that's also been something in the poker, in the fire kind of for a little bit while too. So no surprise that they went after kind of bringing that forward as well to a bit of a higher heat on the stove. What do you think is the significance of these, and is China leaving room for negotiation, or what is the strategy here?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think there's a couple of components here. Is first of all, over the past, since the first phase of the trade war during Trump's first term, China's been really working hard to build out a series of what it calls anti-economic coercion tools. So these are a number of pieces of legislation that effectively provide China with a legal basis for striking back against what it sees as foreign economic suppression. And that's just an acknowledgement of the fact that for so long, it was very easy for a U.S. administration to cripple a major Chinese company with the stroke of a pen or do significant damage to whole industries. And there wasn't a ton that China could really do about it. So in the years since then, we've seen a lot of attention paid to how can we feasibly strike back against this? Because it's not acceptable that our industries are so vulnerable to Western and particularly American pressure. But yes, there's absolutely a negotiation angle here. I think all of these things that I've just mentioned, and indeed the countermeasures that China imposed in the final days of the Biden administration, these are all bargaining chips, right? These are all things that China can then take to the table and say, all right, well, you have this ask on tariffs, but maybe we can work out a deal that enables you to be the hero who saves X, Y, or Z American company from blacklisting in China, or saves them from a result of an antitrust probe that really damages their business. So I think all of this is leverage that China can then deploy. I think also there are more indirect considerations. So there's been suggestions that China may be looking to go after Apple next for an antitrust probe. And I think when you look at Apple, Google, and you kind of compare that with who was at Trump's inauguration front and center, it was these captains of tech industry. So even if you're not thinking about using them at a physical, honest to God negotiating table with Trump's commerce team, right? Maybe there's a degree of indirect influence that can be exerted when these tech CEOs who are apparently quite close to Trump say, hey, this is really damaging. China's really got us over a barrel. Could you do something about it? Right? It's speculative. It's unclear to me at this stage how much Trump will necessarily care about the fate of one company or another. But these are all levers that China can, in theory, use.
One company has not been listed, but I think if you just wanted to pour gasoline on the fire, you would get an antitrust probe into a certain company. It starts with a T, and that would just light everything.
I'm sure I don't know what you mean.
Yeah. Okay, so last week, as of this recording, the U.S. Postal Service suspended packages from China, and then within a few hours, reinstated them. Why? What do you make of that?
So this one, I can really only hazard a guess, and I think possibly that would have been just an administrative pause to deal with the implications of the revocation of de minimis. So again, that's that rule that existed that allowed imports of packages of less than $800 to avoid duties. So I don't know specifically why they announced they were stopping accepting parcels. My only guess would be that they needed to take a second to adjust to think about how to deal with the processing of these parcels under this new, or rather the revocation of this rule. That's all I can, apart from that, your guess is as good as mine.
I feel like I'm watching football sometimes when these things happen, and it's the quarterback motions, you know, the wide receiver to go in motion and just to see if the linebacker follows or not, because he wants to get a better read on the defense he's going to face when he snaps the, you know, it just, yeah, it's a mean, it's like, you know, just want to see what they're going to do. And then, for those of you who don't know football, I apologize for that entire reference. Hey, it was just a Super Bowl, and I'm so happy the Eagles won. But I digress. What is, and I know you kind of touched on this, and it's somewhat of a redundant question, but I do want to ask it. What is the significance of the de minimis exemption being closed for Chinese packages?
Yeah, so that's mainly going to fall on companies like Shein and Temu. Right, these sort of fast fashion or just otherwise relatively cheap retailers, and that's sort of a major part of their whole business model is the assumption that prior to now they could ship packages to the U.S. without being subject to duty. So I think that is, you know, they will take a small hit, but like so much of this stuff, I think that they, you know, the revocation or tightening of de minimis has been on the cards for a very long time. That was something that was discussed under the Biden administration as well. So this surely will not come as any surprise. And so I think that these companies are going to find ways to adjust. So, you know, I think that, I mean, again, I've already just kind of anecdotally seen people posting on social media saying, how come I have to now pay this duty on my package from Shein? And, you know, this is sort of the result of geopolitics, and it does, at least in sort of that limited way, it does bring up prices for American consumers. But, you know, I do think that these companies that have heretofore relied on the de minimis exemption are they'll find workarounds.
All right. Well, if you work at Temu and you're listening, I ordered some cat scratch furniture protective material. And I'd really like to get that because my cat is squirrely AF. And so if we could get that sent over, I'd really appreciate that. My furniture is being torn to shreds. Now, let's talk about semiconductors. What is the latest in semiconductor related measures from the US?
So, interesting. There has been discussion of semiconductor related restrictions, but not in the direction you might expect. It's come in the form of Donald Trump saying he wants to impose tariffs on Taiwanese semiconductors. So that, I think, goes back to his preoccupation with the idea that Taiwan somehow took away American semiconductor business, and he's unhappy with that. In terms of measures impacting the mainland, as far as I've seen, I mean, I really haven't seen any indication that he's likely to carry on with some of the quite stringent Biden administration restrictions, things like the AI diffusion rule, things like leaning on American allies to cut China's supply of advanced chips. You know, it's possible that he may just decline to walk those restrictions from the Biden era back. But it seems to me that Trump's preferred method to solve just about everything is tariffs. So sort of these somewhat more technical export controls based on the concept that we want to, plug gaps that allow China to get its hands on advanced semiconductors. He, at least until now, hasn't expressed much attention to that one way or the other. I don't necessarily think he's going to walk back those restrictions. I mean, it's possible as part of a deal that he could, but it seems like he's mainly focusing on a tariff-based approach right now. And again, targeting a region that, you know, theoretically, if you were to have a cohesive strategy that allowed the U.S. to sort of maintain its stranglehold over high-end chips while denying them to China, it seems like you wouldn't then go after Taiwanese chips. But yeah, who knows?
I was going to say, like, I don't know if he understands how layered that whole thing is. I mean, I'm sure he does. He's probably got people in his ear telling him just how layered that can be. But anytime you bring Taiwan into the picture, that adds complexity to the whole narrative. Now, with the buzz around DeepSeek, and for everybody who hasn't heard about this, it was it's an incredible AI rivals ChatGPT that China rolled out that looks to be just as good as ChatGPT by all accounts, and was developed at a fraction of the cost. So that really kind of threw not only Silicon Valley, but Wall Street into quite the tizzy. I think there was almost a billion in tech cap that got lost when this kind of was announced. Do you expect, because of DeepSeek, do you expect Trump to impose additional restrictions?
Ooh, so I will preface this by saying, first and foremost, I'm not a tech guy. I think what Trump said is he referred to it as a wake-up call, which suggests to me that he maybe sees it as more of a spur for U.S. companies to up their game rather than something to be squashed. And I mean, sort of as far as I understand it, the thing about DeepSeek is it is, in theory, an AI model that is less vulnerable to these sort of restrictions from the U.S. side. So maybe that becomes less relevant, the need to get your hands on the highest end chips. You know, I think with DeepSeek in general, it's simply too soon to say. One other piece to consider here is that a lot of the gap plugging that the Biden administration did with regard to advanced chips getting to China was sort of cajoling American partners and allies like the Netherlands, like Japan, like South Korea, to essentially enforce their compliance and ensure that they were not exporting either high-end chips or high-end chip-making equipment to China. With the way things are going under Trump 2.0 so far and his comfort with alienating U.S. allies and partners, and maybe the calculus changes in those countries. If they feel like they're not being treated with due respect by the U.S. or they're not getting enough out of the partnership, then maybe they say, okay, well, we don't see there's anything wrong with selling chips and shipping equipment to China, and there may be less willingness to comply. That's speculative, but I think that's maybe a dimension that's worth considering.
Joe, you always bring it. You're always so intelligent. You're always so prepared. I'm sure there's a lot of people listening that would like to get more from you. Talk to us a little bit about Trivium and where can people follow, you know, your writing and your research?
Yeah, well, so Trivium China is a boutique consulting firm. We focus, as the name suggests, on China. We're headquartered in Beijing, but we have offices in DC as well, and a scattering of people all over the world. And we're sort of best known for our three daily newsletters that cover politics, markets, and tech. We also have a free daily newsletter, which highlights what is, in our opinion, the biggest thing happening in China news that day. We also have a podcast, which not to take part. Obviously, you should be listening to the Negotiation Podcast first and foremost. But if you really can't get enough, then you can hop onto wherever it is you listen to podcasts. So Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and just type in the Trivium Podcast and you can hear our insights beamed directly into your ears.
Okay. Joe Mazur, senior analyst at Trivium China. Thank you very much for coming on the show, buddy. We really appreciate your time.
Thanks a bunch, Todd.
Okay. So the video version is over at the WPIC YouTube channel. Obviously, the audio version is available on all your favorite podcast platforms. Please subscribe. download, like, 5-star, everywhere you can. It's a shameless ask, but man, this is what the algorithms are all about, and it really helps us in ways that you cannot imagine. So we really appreciate that. If you want to reach out to us, podcast@wpic.co. We'll take all your advice, all your suggestions. And if you have any guests that you'd like to recommend or that you'd like to hear on the show, let us know, and we will try to go and get them. But from me and everybody at The Negotiation, and for Joe, thanks very much for listening and or watching, and we'll see you next time.
Growing a company is hard. Doing it in a foreign market, exponentially so. The best piece of advice I can give you is not to do it alone. When you start looking at the Asia-Pacific region for further expansion possibilities, and I sincerely hope you do, make sure you choose the right partners to do it with. My good friends at WPIC Marketing and Technologies have almost 20 years of experience helping brands, just like yours, enter China, Japan, and Southeast Asia. I hope you enjoyed this episode of The Negotiation, and if you're interested in being a guest or want to connect with me or any of our team, please reach out to us at podcast@wpic.co, and be sure to rate, comment, and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.